Welcome, guys, to Behind the Shield. This is episode 43, and I'm your host, James Gearing. And this week, I am very proud to bring you another member of the armed services. We've had such an array from Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Delta Force, Marines, and I'm bringing you a Marine pilot this time. Lieutenant Colonel David Burke has walked the walk in so many positions. Started off as a trainee fighter pilot, went through Top Gun school, became a Top Gun instructor, then took himself out of the planes and put himself absolutely in the middle of it all on the ground next to the SEALs and the Marines, guiding air attacks from the ground. So he's had a unique perspective from, you know, the academy, from fighting from the air to fighting from the ground. So we really delve in preparation, in training, in mindset, in ownership. And it's incredible, as you'll see as the interview unfolds, the parallel between his training, you know, at the absolute elite Top Gun level and what's expected of the firefighter, the paramedic, the policeman. And the training for the what ifs, the worst case scenarios, because as you'll hear as the interview unfolds, they train for everything they could think of, and then situations came about, certainly after 9/11, where they were thrown into a scenario that they'd never anticipated. So this philosophy of we never get fires anymore, it'll never happen, and getting complacent, it's something that I've been totally against. You'll see yet another incredible officer at the highest level and the highest trained, you know, elite pilot say exactly the same things that many of our inspired men and women in the law enforcement and fire community preach all the time. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you Lieutenant Colonel David Burke. Before we start, please remember, rate us on iTunes and share. The more people that listen to these incredible minds, and we're getting so many amazing people now, the more lives are going to be changed. So the better the departments are going to be, the healthier the men and women working there are going to be, the better relationships are going to have with their family. This is going to be a ripple effect. So please help me, you know, spread this message. I'm merely the conduit, and I'm having these incredible minds coming on. And my goal is literally to aggressively get this message out to as many people as possible. This is a free podcast. None of these men or women, you know, have charged me a thing to come on as well. So all we can do is share it and get these messages out there. So I introduce to you an amazing interview with Lieutenant Colonel Dave Burke. Thank you. Welcome to Behind the Shield, Lieutenant Colonel Burke. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, where are we finding you this morning?
I'm just on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. on a Thursday morning here.
Fantastic. Okay. So I was given your name after contacting your group Echelon Front. And I've had the honor of delving into your career and learning a lot about you the last few days. But I'd love to start at the very beginning and paint the picture and kind of lead us down the path of what led you to where you are now. So to start off, where were you born and what was your family unit like?
So I was born in New York, but I really grew up in Southern California. I moved to San Diego when I was just over a year old. So really consider myself not a native technically, but certainly a Southern Californian. And so I spent most of my childhood between San Diego and Orange County, and I lived there up until the time that I left the Marine Corps. My parents moved out there when I was young, and then eventually, by the time of five or six, it was just my mom, my sister, and I living in Orange County, and I stayed there until I got commissioned in the Marine Corps and moved off to Virginia from there.
Okay, whereabouts in Orange County did you live?
I grew up in a town called Lake Forest, which was right outside the outskirts of a Marine base called Marine Corps Air Station El Toro, which was a jet base for the Marine Corps for decades. And I grew up watching Marine airplanes fly overhead through basically all of my childhood.
Okay, because I used to work for Anaheim Fire Department, so I lived in Huntington Beach.
Well, I know it well. Yeah, I went to school at Cal State Fullerton, which is just around the corner from the Big A, and spent my life going to Angels games, and I know it really well. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic! All right. So, when you were young, were you an athlete?
Nobody would ever accuse me of being a great athlete. I did play sports, you know, all my life growing up. I played baseball was my favorite sport. And I played baseball for many years, but not in college or anything like that. So I guess, like I said, nobody's gonna ever accuse me of being a great athlete. But I did play sports a lot growing up.
Okay, and so I've heard the story myself. I listened to yours and Jocko podcast, but I thought it was a very fascinating journey as to how you found yourself in the military, unlike a lot of people that kind of graduated and then found themselves at a crossroads and then ended up heading that way. So you knew pretty early on exactly what you wanted to do, didn't you?
Yeah, very early. I would say probably by 14 or 15, I knew I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be in the military. By 16, I was very specific that I wanted to fly F-18s for the Marine Corps. So from the time that I kind of figured out I really liked flying and I wanted to fly for the military to the time I knew exactly what I wanted to do was, you know, a couple of years in there, but happened at a very young age.
Okay. And how did that motivate you in school?
Well, that's a good question. So I, you know, I was always a decent student. I did well in school, nothing off the charts, but I knew if you want to be a pilot in the Marine Corps, you got to go to college. You got to get a degree. You want to be an officer in any of the services, you have to graduate from college. And since I knew, you know, probably by early in my, you know, sophomore, junior year in high school that that's what I wanted to do, I made sure that I put myself in a position to do it. I did well enough in school to go to college. I just went to a local state school. I didn't have big aspirations of any particular school to attend. So I actually just went to the school closest to my house. I drove, you know, I was a commuter. I went to school, lived at home, worked a lot while I was in college to pay for school. And at the time, to be honest with you, I viewed college as kind of a path to get to what I wanted. About halfway through my time in college, I realized that I was actually paying for an education, and I started to view school a little bit differently. Certainly my freshman and sophomore year was just, I got to do this because I've got other plans. And I came to realize just how valuable the education was that I was getting. I didn't want to waste that either. So I kind of changed my approach to school in the latter half of my college years and got a lot more out of it than I probably had in the previous. But again, it was all towards the end of getting a degree, earning my commission, and going off to the Marine Corps.
Okay. And how valuable did you find the actual degree portion? Obviously, when you got into the military itself, then it was probably a lot more job-specific training. But that college portion, did it pertain well to what you did in your career?
So I was a political science major in college. I wasn't an engineer. The thing I really liked about the Marine Corps is that they weren't really interested, at least back then. You know, this is 1991 when I started to go to officer candidate school. I got my degree in 94. The Marine Corps wasn't really interested in a particular background. They didn't expect you to be an engineer or a scientist or have any of that. They wanted someone who was capable of leading Marines. My degree per se didn't offer any unique skill set that was usable for the Marine Corps in any particular sense. But I did find when I learned how to apply myself, when I learned how to take advantage of opportunity to learn, that was a skill that was really valuable. Because the trick about being a successful Marine, I think a trick about being successful anywhere, is you have to take the most out of the opportunities you have. And I was kind of wasting is maybe a strong word, but I certainly wasn't taking advantage of that for a couple of years. But like I said, the latter half of my college career, I learned how to take advantage and get the full benefit of it. And I applied that certainly throughout my Marine Corps career and have throughout life since then.
Okay. So the reason I ask is as a fireman, I went through university as well. But it's interesting, some of the professions and obviously the military, once you get in, fire, police, when you enter that sort of educational realm and you're being taught specifically what you need for that profession, it seems very pertinent. But I found, this is just my own personal opinion, but it's something that I think maybe we need to look at as a nation in our educational system, is some of the college level stuff. I feel like it could be a lot more pertinent to where you are headed, as opposed to these general courses that we're forcing, you know, our young students to go through before they can get to the point where they really learn their trade.
Yeah, and I assume there's a balance there. I mean, I think having a particular trade is critical, and that's something when you go to school for a particular skill set, trade schools or professional schools that give you that skill. I mean, that's great. I do think there's also value in having a generic and broad education. I think being too specific and too narrow at a young age isn't always the right approach. And I think there's certainly, like with anything, I think there's a balance. And I found myself, even with the general education things that I was doing in college, you know, a lot of people have to find what's interesting to them. And I've also found that things that you might think you're really interested in at one point, those things change. And I think sometimes you outgrow particular interests. So it's important, I think, to have as broad of experience as you can and migrate to the things that are most interesting to you. I look back at my college years, and especially the latter half of my college years, they were extremely valuable for me for a lot of different reasons. And it wasn't just studying the classes that I cared about or wanted to study. It was that I learned that there was something I could grow from in every single class that I took, whether it was a chemistry class or a political science class or anything in between. So I agree with you that there needs to be a balance there of a broad range of things, and also allow people to specialize into a skill that take them right into a particular trade that they like to do or want to do.
Brilliant. Okay, so you graduated from college. So what was your initial entry into military like and the boot camp experience?
So I went to officer candidate school, which is kind of the entrance criteria for the Marine Corps to be an officer. And I did that while I was in college. And I did something that was called the platoon leaders class, which is where most Marines get their commission. Some are RTC, some go to the Naval Academy, but most Marines, at least then, are platoon leaders class. These are the guys that go to officer candidate school during the summers during their college years. And I did that. And that was at the time, you know, I was 18 years old, I think, when I went to OCS in 1991. It was a huge challenge for me. It was something that for the first time that I had all these dreams and fantasies about what I wanted to do. It was the first time I had to do something practical and actually go do the work that was required to get down the road of being an F-18 pilot, which at that point was many years off. It was a huge challenge for me. It was a huge challenge and something that I figured out as I was doing it, that I actually was going to be able to succeed. When I went there, I wasn't as confident as maybe some other folks were, probably a little intimidated by what lied ahead. But it turned out that I was able to do it, and it was a huge growth and learning experience for me.
Okay, now, touching back to the educational, were you a gifted student? Was all the educational side easy for you?
Gifted is probably another word that nobody was ever going to use to describe me. Look, I suffered from just being very lazy. I was the kind of kid that if I did almost nothing, I was going to be able to get B's and get by no problem, stay underneath the radar and not cause any problems, not put myself in a difficult situation and not get much out of it. So I was a perennial B student through a lot of my life, mostly through the fact that I discovered it took no effort to be a B student. The last couple of years, when I started to apply myself differently and realized I was not just investing a huge amount of time, I was investing my own money. I paid my way through college. It was actual money that I was spending on this education. I discovered that I wanted to do better. And so I started to work harder and I was able to get, you know, I got good grades and I did well, but it took a ton more of application on my part, but I learned so much more. So sadly, you could probably look at some of my high school years and at least a year or two of college where I didn't get a huge return on the investment because the investment wasn't really there. And when I made the investment, and obviously the grades, you know, get better because you're working harder, but the amount that I learned was just exponentially higher. I was a little late in figuring that out. I certainly had friends and peers in high school that were way ahead of me on that curve.
Right. So you had this burning desire from when you were in your mid-teens, and that was the driving force through all the adversity that you encountered along the educational experience.
I just wanted to get in a time machine and start flying airplanes. You know, I was a kid that had this real specific dream, and I just wanted to do it. And I kind of, I would get ahead of myself sometimes. And I, at some point, I realized, hey, this is going to be a long, challenging road. If you're going to accomplish exactly what you want to accomplish, and I had some very specific objectives, that you had to take it step by step, and you had to do very well at every step in the process. And that was a lesson. I just had to learn that lesson, and it was challenging for me. And when I figured it out, I applied myself and I was able to do it. But at 16, I just wanted to just accelerate past all those things that I thought were just time consuming. What it turns out in retrospect, those are the things that make you what you are. And those are the things you need to apply yourself. That's a hard lesson for a kid to learn. I was lucky enough to figure it out early enough that I was able to follow through with the things that I wanted to do to actually achieve those specific objectives that I had set at such a young age.
Yeah, and you set yourself a very narrow objective, didn't you? Because you wanted to be a pilot, but a pilot of a very specific plane at a very specific base. Is that correct?
Yeah, I knew, with great detail, probably too much detail at that time, exactly what I wanted to do. I remember even picturing what squadron I wanted to be in. I was lucky enough to have access to that Marine base, that Marine Corps Station El Toro, as a young kid. And I would look at the squadrons. They had big signs painted on the side of the hangars. And I remember two of the squadrons vividly that I really wanted to be in. So I even knew down to the squadron what I wanted to do really young. Not that I recommend having objectives that specific, but there's no question in my mind. Knowing what I wanted to do was a driver for me in accomplishing what I wanted to do.
Okay. Now, so you had this burning desire, you signed up, you enlisted with the Marines. I'm assuming, as I heard in your podcast with Jocko, they'll say yes. Most recruiters will say yes to whatever, the man or woman says they want to do, but obviously you actually made it happen. So what was it? How did you make a regular Marine enlistment turn into you actually going to flight school?
So I joined the Marine Corps, or I contracted to join the Marine Corps as an officer, as a ground officer. And at the time, again, I was 17 when I was showing up to the Marine Corps officer candidate recruiter. We called him an OSO, which is essentially a recruiter for an officer. And I was telling them, what I wanted to do. And I remember at the time being told, hey, you contract as a ground officer. We don't have an air contract for you, but that's an opportunity that will present itself down the road. At 17, when I was being told I could contract to join the Marine Corps, I would have taken anything they offered. And I did. And I went to officer candidate school, completed that program and completed college as a ground contract. And then I went to the basic school. We called it TBS. That's really the first real educational experience. You get exposed to all the different jobs in the Marine Corps. You're being graded, you're being evaluated for your leadership, for your physical fitness, for your military skills, and you're getting ranked against your peers. And that's the process where, based on your ranking and based on your interests, is where they assign you your job. We called it an MOS, a military occupational specialty, really just the career field that you're going to end up. A lot of guys go to TBS. Well, a decent amount of guys go to TBS with an air contract already. They contracted for pilot training. And so no matter how they did at the basic school, as long as they passed, they were going to go to flight school. I did not have a contract, so I had to compete for, at the time, I think when I got to the basic school, they told us there were going to be two pilots selected for that class. I think at the end, they might have selected a total of four, but I was able to get that second air slot and get to flight training out of the basic school. I basically took the hardest route possible to get to flight training.
And how
it did work out. So
I'm sorry. And how many candidates was that out of?
So there's 250 guys in the class. Again, not all of them have air contracts. I'm sorry, not all of them have ground contracts. So of the 250, we probably had maybe 190. It's a real guess. I couldn't give you a real number, but a good number of folks that you're competing with there. Now, not everybody wants to be a pilot. Not everybody's qualified to be a pilot. So that number gets smaller. It's not 250, that you're competing with. But a good amount of folks go there, want to fly airplanes, and a good amount of folks are competing for that. And, there's requirements along the way. There's processes you got to get through, and people can't fulfill some of those requirements, the physical requirements, the eyesight, all those other things that go along with that. And at the end, the guys that are remaining, you get ranked against them. And in that case, they just took the top two guys and gave them their first choice. And it turned out my roommate was the first guy. He's the guy who was ahead of me. He was the number one guy for air contract. And I was behind him, a good buddy of mine who went on to be a pilot as well.
Fantastic. And I want to underline something, because as someone that's already in the profession, and certainly as anyone listening that's looking to get into not only the military, but especially police and fire and EMS, I'm always asked, what do you need to do to succeed? And you hear a lot of this, oh, it's who you know, and all these excuse mentality. But I've always told the people that have asked me, well, there's certain areas that you can control, and you touched on fitness, you touched on grades. You know, if you are as fit as you can possibly be, and you've studied your ass off for the tests that you need to get through, you can own that portion and increase your success. Was that the same in your road?
100%. I mean, look, anybody that joins the military, anybody joins any organization where you're there to serve, whether it's a first responder, police, fire, EMTs, medical, all those career fields where really you're serving your country or you're serving your community, the needs of that organization are always going to come first. The needs of the Marine Corps are paramount to anybody. When you sign on the dotted line, you're volunteering your life and your commitment to serve the country. So that should be understood. If anybody goes there expecting things to happen for them, they're going to be reminded that that's not why they're there. But the beauty is people join because they understand that service is important, and that's how it works. With that said, there's a ton of things that you can control. And the idea of relinquishing that control to the military, yeah, you have to do that, but you shouldn't relinquish anything that you have any influence over. And the bottom line is the things that are required, certainly for me, the things that I needed to do to get what I wanted, I understood that. It was very clearly laid out. I had to do well in the areas that were evaluated. I knew what those areas were. Like I said, I can remember it to this day. It's been 26 years ago. They measure you in your leadership ability. They measure you in your military skills ability, and they measure you in your physical fitness ability. And the better you are in those categories, the more likely you are going to be towards the top of your class. And the better you are in your class, the more likely you are to get what you want. There's an old saying in the Marine Corps, if you want your first choice, finish first. And everybody after that is going to get what's left over. And you know, anything that you're not able to do that you have control over is one less opportunity you have to accomplish what you want. At the end, you can do everything right. You can do everything perfect. You can be great at all those things. And if the needs of the Marine Corps are something else, then so be it. And that's a pill I think all of us can swallow. I was not going to put myself in a position where I was outperformed by my peers and had to relinquish an opportunity to somebody else because they did better than me. Now, there are always people out there better shape, you know, and better at those qualities, but I was going to work as hard as I could to be as good as I could and with the hope that I finished high enough to get what I wanted. And if you do well enough, you're going to get what you want in the Marine Corps or any service most of the time. And it worked out.
Fantastic. So I want to underline another point. We in the fire service, we have what's called minimum standards. That's when we go through the fire school, you know, throw our ladders, drag our hose. And I love the fact that it's called that because that literally gives you the key to the lock of your profession.
Yeah.
And now your learning really begins. There are some lesser firefighters that see that as a hurdle. And once they're done, the lazy boy is going to be their best friend for the next 30 years. I'm assuming to become an F-18 pilot that you cannot have that mentality. So what is it like once we've passed all the hoops that you had to jump through to get there?
Well, the thing of that is what you described, and we have that as well. There are minimum standards for every job in the Marine Corps, every job in the military, and you have to fulfill those minimum standards to even just stick around the military. But the challenge and the beauty of what I wanted to do is there were hurdles along the way. There was a ton of phases. There was officer candidate school. You know, even before that, there was college. There was officer candidate school. There was the basic school. There was academics before flight training. Then there was initial flight training, intermediate flight training, advanced flight training. There's all these different phases. And at each phase, the same thing is happening. You're being ranked against your peers. Your performance is being judged. Your capabilities are being evaluated. And all that goes into an aggregate composite evaluation. And then they align that with what you want and what's available. At any phase that you get lazy, you're going to get off the path of accomplishing what you want. And if you were like me and you were very specific that I didn't want to just do anything, I wanted to do something very, very specific, I knew what the glide path was to get there, and I had to do well at every single phase. And at any point in my career, had I not continued to apply myself as much as I could, there was very high risk that I wasn't going to get what I wanted because there just weren't a ton of spots to fly F-18s in San Diego. As you might guess, that pyramid gets more and more narrow as you go on. And the benefit of knowing exactly what you want is that it is completely up to you to perform at a level to make sure you get what you want. And I just was unwilling at a very young age and very unwilling throughout my initial phase of my career to jeopardize anything that would have gotten jeopardized accomplishing what I wanted by letting something get in my way. I always figured that the investment up front was going to be well worth it, because if I was flying the airplane that I wanted to fly in the place I wanted to fly it, I look back and say, man, that was worth it. But if I did something dumb or stupid or got lazy or didn't put in my best effort and I wasn't flying the Hornet out of Miramar, I look back and I'd be haunted by that decision for the rest of my life. If I did everything right and did put in my best effort and never got off the path and it didn't work out, I can sleep at night with that. That's life, that circumstance, those are the needs of the Marine Corps, those things happen. But there is no way it's going to have anything to do with me and my failure to exert myself to the max extent possible. And I just committed myself to that. And, you know, that never stops. You know, some people, you know, may be satisfied with what they have. I mean, when you get to the F-18 unit, and then you want to get the squadron you want, so you have to do well. When you get to the squadron you want, if you want to go to Top Gun, you have to do well. And all these opportunities to continue to improve and develop are always there. There is no place where you just sort of stop. And if you do, that's a personal choice. And it's, if you're satisfied with what you got, that's fine. But I never was. And that was a motivator for me throughout my entire career. Cause there's always opportunities to grow and develop and improve.
Absolutely. And I'm assuming that you would expect the same from the policemen and firemen that protect your family.
Of course. And that's why like I said, service is service. Some people do it in the military. Some people do it. And I talked about, you know, first responders, EMT, fire, police. The term service is to me, it's synonymous with just committing yourself to doing something for your community, your state, or your country. And people that do that, there's a million different ways to serve. And if you can't serve in the military, you don't want to serve in the military, there's an infinite number of ways to serve. And we get asked that question all the time. If I don't want to join the military, what should I do? How can I serve? And that the list of things to do is a mile long. And that's great, as long as you understand that it requires a huge amount of effort and sacrifice on your part, and the needs of the unit or the community that you're serving come before your own needs. And it's beautiful that we both live in countries where people are still willing to do that and make that sacrifice, no matter what form it comes in.
Absolutely. Well, I want to expand on that point a little bit. So again, listening to your interview on Jocko's show, when you first entered when you first became a fighter pilot, we weren't actively in any combat at the moment. Is that correct?
No, we were doing, so it was after Operation Desert Storm, which happened in 91. And then we were doing what was called Operation Southern Watch. We were just monitoring the no-fly zone, which is about as crazy as combat was back then, as mostly just flying patrol zones in northern and southern Iraq. So there really wasn't, you know, by today's standard, there really was nothing going on, very little at least.
Okay, so what was training like? Because a challenge that we have at the moment, especially in the fire service, is buildings are getting safer. You know, buildings have burnt down; they've rebuilt them with sprinklers and alarms, and we're just not seeing the fires that our, you know, glory years, 60s and 70s firefighters had before. You can look at that two ways. You can look at that with that means we need to train more, or you can be complacent. And sadly, you know, there's a lot of if it hasn't happened, it's not going to happen. Instead of if it hasn't happened, the likelihood is increasing every single day that it will. So when you were in those peace years, were you still training just as aggressively as if you had been in wartime?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, we were when I first got to the fleet, when I got finished with training and got to a combat unit or training in an airplane, the Hornet, to prepare for combat. Yeah, we were in the middle of those lean years, you know, 1998, 97, 98, 99. And there certainly wasn't anything like what we're doing now facing the country. I found myself migrating towards people that took that profession really seriously. And I think the Marine Corps as a service has always been very good about preparing for difficult situations. Now, I don't think anybody there forecasted any event like 9/11, and they didn't forecast these long wars that we're currently involved in now, in the sense of that's what they anticipated. But there was no question that certainly the units that I was in, and I think the Marine Corps across the board still understood that war, it was always explained to me, war is just a matter of time. War is going to happen. War is going to be inevitable. We have not fought our last war. And I never found myself anywhere where there was any level of complacency. Now, that doesn't mean we were necessarily training for the right missions. It didn't mean that we were training correctly all the time, because anticipating that is actually really difficult. And in retrospect, yeah, there's a ton of things we could have done differently to be more prepared. But that's always in hindsight. I mean, that's just the way the world works. But I always appreciated being in a service and always appreciated being in squadrons, and certainly at Top Gun as well, appreciated being in a place where the idea of conflict, the idea of combat, the idea of putting yourself in harm's way, it was just a matter of time. It was absolutely going to happen. So I felt that we were as prepared as we could have been, in the sense of knowing that we were always training for conflict and it was going to happen. And it did, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to want to transition to that in a second. But analogy that I like to use, you know, to the fire service specifically, is the Secret Service protecting the president. I'm assuming those guys aren't shooting assassins left, right, and center. So they're not getting that action in the actual role. But I'm also making the assumption that when they are not standing next to the president, they're out training like maniacs on the other days.
You know, the smart ones are, you know, and I think we have a lot of folks that do that. The more challenging, the more difficult, the more realistic, the more overwhelming the practice is, the more likely you are going to succeed in the real world. And look, I know guys that spent their whole career preparing and they didn't see combat. Things, you know, timing and such worked out. Guys left. Or for whatever reason, they didn't find themselves in combat. Although if you're around long enough, most people did in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, as you know. But the guys that took it seriously, the organizations, the squadrons, the units that took it seriously, they prepared for an outcome that they thought was a fact of life. It was just a matter of time. And they took that really seriously. And the folks that trained hard are the folks that succeed. And that's part of the reason why guys like Jocko Willink and Leif Babin are such successful guys, that they prepared in a way that the training that they did is so tough and so challenging and so realistic and so demanding, that they were prepared for in really complex combat situations, which they performed really well. It's because they took the preparation so seriously. I agree with that approach. I took that same approach, and most of the guys that I would consider my friends in squadrons took that same approach as well, even before the wars kicked off.
Absolutely. Okay, well, talking about that, so you were in basically peacetime, and then 9/11 happened. I know you had a very the fighter pilots in general had a very unusual set of orders after that. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, being stationed at Miramar in just a regular combat squadron, when I got to work the morning of September 11th, I mean, I remember my commanding officer calling me saying, hey, clearly we didn't know what was happening. We had not a very good grasp of the situation. And his guidance was, you need to prepare to launch, you know, with four F-18s with live ordnance. And we didn't know it was called at the time Operation Noble Eagle. It was that mission where they launched aircraft. We were on San Diego on the coast of Southern California, and there were, I don't know how many dozens of long-haul commercial airliners still airborne, flying those Asia-Pacific routes, you know, those 12, 13, 14-hour flights, still flying towards the West Coast. And this was just a couple hours after the Pentagon and the World Trade Center had been attacked by aircraft. And so there was this concern that it was going to continue. We didn't know what to expect. And I remember sitting in the writing room with, you know, good friends of mine, guys I'm still in touch with today in some cases, preparing to conduct that mission. Obviously, you know, that didn't happen. Thank God we never found ourselves in a position to do it. But really what it spoke to was how unprepared we were for what was going on. And, you know, that is kind of a segue from that previous conversation about preparing. You know, I'll be candid, we never talked about in my career up until that point shooting down a commercial airliner. It just was never something we considered, and thank goodness it didn't have to happen. But boy, it was certainly an eye-opener that the morning of September 11th, I'm in the ready room at my squadron in Miramar briefing a mission for that, and trying to go through as quickly as we can, you know, potential outcomes and potential scenarios and how he would handle it. And my squadron, I think that day, and maybe the next morning at the latest, was flying operations off the coast of LAX. And I can still to this day vividly remember flying over Los Angeles International Airport and seeing other airplanes from my squadron as well who had taken off and were flying, you know, patrol missions over the top of the airport. And I'm looking down and, you know, there's God knows how many airplanes on the runways there, and everything was shut down. There was no controllers. There's no airplanes in the sky. And if you've ever been in Southern California, there's airplanes everywhere all the time. And there was not a single airplane flying. It was a surreal experience there, and that was the first couple of days of Operation Noble Eagle. I think it was September 11th, 12th, 13th, something like those 3 days. And, you know, we're still flying that same missions today. Noble Eagle is still going on, you know, protecting Americans from, you know, any potential air attack that may occur during big events like the Super Bowl inauguration, those type of big gatherings. So at the time, we were definitely on our heels, and we had to get up to speed very quickly.
Yeah, and there's no way of really, you know, anticipating the way some of these attacks are happening. I work for the fire department that protects Disney here in Florida. And you know, if you want to stick a bullseye on an area, that's pretty much, I would say, one of the top ones on the planet. And, you know, my mentality is you've got to prepare, as we said, as hard as possible just to have the white belt level response, because whatever's going to happen is going to be so far out left field, most likely, that you're going to at least need that framework to fall back on, because the reality is it's still going to be an absolute nightmare to try and mitigate.
Yeah, I think you said it very well. You know, you can't predict the future. You can do your best to be as prepared as you can, but there are always things that occur that you just didn't anticipate. And I think that goes into being flexible and being as malleable as you can, but also being able to react when the environment is new and difficult. And that goes into, you know, the most complex training you can create. It may not replicate what ends up happening in the real world, but it gets you very used to reacting effectively and quickly in environments that you're uncomfortable with. And I think the idea of being able to perform while you're uncomfortable is really critical. And it's something that all of us in the services, you know, military, fire, et cetera, have to be able to do. You might not be able to train for the specific event because you can't predict it, but you can certainly get comfortable with performing well when you're uncomfortable. And that's something I had to get used to doing. And that really marked my career because that happened to me a lot.
All right. Well, we're talking about you know, the next step of your career. So firstly, I know that you said that you were inspired to become a pilot by the movie Top Gun. Is that correct?
Yeah. And, you know, as silly as it is to say, I don't think a single pilot in my generation didn't watch that movie and decide that they wanted to fly fighters after watching it. So, yeah, I absolutely did love that movie.
Okay. And don't worry, we're the same with Ladder 49 and Backdraft. So we all have
there you
our...
go. Yeah, Backdraft was awesome.
but you actually, again, making your crystal clear dream come true, you found yourself at the Top Gun school. So can you tell me, firstly, for all of us non-military personnel, what the school is, and then you know, what your experience was in there?
Yeah, so Top Gun is the Navy, the United States Navy's fighter weapons school. It's the school, it's been around since 1969. It's a school that really is designed to train fighter pilots, naval aviators, that's Navy and Marine jet pilots, to not just be highly capable to perform in combat, but to be instructors and teachers in their own units, to lead their squadrons in combat. And, you know, at the time it was a movie, certainly, and the movie is nothing like the real world. I mean, it's a movie, and I don't want to ruin anybody's imagination, but, you know, the real world is a lot different. But certainly by reputation, everybody in the world knows about Top Gun. And if you're a fighter pilot in the Navy, the Marine Corps, you know, Top Gun really does represent you know, the place where you want to be. It's the top of the pyramid there, and it's something we all aspire to, and it's something, well, I shouldn't say all, just about all of us aspire to. Something I certainly aspire to, and I knew in the back of my mind that getting to go to Top Gun as a student was a dream. It was something I think would have really marked my career and would have represented kind of achieving the pinnacle of being a fighter pilot. And when you go as a student and you get to go back to be an instructor, it's just all the more satisfying, because it's there's no place like it. You know, you have a tremendous amount of responsibility, but I've never been so good at flying. I've never learned so much. I've never had such an opportunity to impact so many people as I did at Top Gun.
Okay, and then you became an instructor as well. So you were not only a student, but a teacher there. Yeah. What was the difference between the Top Gun graduates as far as mindset and the men and women that didn't make it?
Well, you know, as far as mindset, you know, it was a rare event. Maybe I can think of one guy at the top of my head, maybe two guys that ended up going to Top Gun that you could tell just didn't want to be there. And how they got there, I can't really speak intelligent to that. You know, the squadron COs, you know, have a lot of say in that. But I would say almost universal, except for one or two rare exceptions, the mindset of guys getting there was all very similar. Guys wanted to be there. They were doing something that they really wanted to do. They had proven themselves in whatever ways they needed to get selected to go as a student.
And most students do well there. Most guys go to Top Gun and they do well. You know, it's not common, you know, it's not big attrition rate to get rid of guys there, but there are guys that don't get through, and they don't get through for any number of reasons. And the biggest reason that guys don't get through isn't about performance. It isn't that they aren't good enough. You know, every now and then you got a guy that just can't meet that minimum standard. And the minimum standard is high at Top Gun. It's a high bar, but most people are able to meet that minimum standard. The expectation at Top Gun is to be able to teach, be able to identify your mistakes and teach people about your performance and what they need to do better, not just execute well. And so it's one thing to get really good at your craft and be able to fly an airplane well. It's hard to do, and it's important. It's a whole nother thing to be able to break down every phase of brief execution for you and every other aircraft around you, understand what happened, and explain to everybody else in the room how they need to improve and do better and how you need to improve and do better. And that is really the difference maker. Top Gun is about teaching and instructing and leading. It's not about performance. And some guys who even flew good airplanes couldn't explain themselves, couldn't instruct, couldn't teach, couldn't break down what happened. And that's the problem, I think, for most guys that can't get through.
Okay, yeah, because I heard you talking about how all the planes were the same. So the what it comes down to was the pilot's ability. Is that correct?
Yeah, at Top Gun, it's a level playing field for the most part. You know, certainly now, I mean, when I first got to Top Gun, we had two different airplanes, but even during my time there, we'd phased out an older generation fighter, and everybody was there flying the F-18. You had minor differences between airplanes, little variations, little different, you know, small differences between aircraft, but really, really small differences. The bottom line is everybody was flying the same quality, same capability of an aircraft. So the playing field in that sense is leveled. So the evaluation is really your performance. You couldn't hide behind, an aircraft that didn't do well. So it was very clear when things weren't going well, what the root cause of those things were. And because of that, you know, you can measure people's performance against each other and against the standard very easily. And so errors, flaws, mistakes, things that didn't go the way it was supposed to are pretty obvious. They're pretty glaring because people understand them because they present themselves very clearly. And the ability to identify and explain those is really what Top Gun is there to do.
Okay. And I think it was in an article that you wrote was when you first went into that part of training, you were looking for perfection, to be flawless. What was it that you found when you were, you know, when you challenged that thought?
Oh, well, I've learned something that I think everybody in the world knows. And I think it's something I learned many times in my life or relearned many times in my life. But the idea of perfection is just, it's ridiculous. There's no such thing as perfection. There's no perfect execution. There's no perfect outcome. Nothing is ever perfect. When you look at a place like Top Gun, when you look at the pilots that are there, when you aspire to that, and when you're part of it and you look up to these mentors and these people that are teaching you how to perform at that high level, you kind of put them on a pedestal and you think these guys are perfect. They're just able to do things that I can't do, or I want to learn how to do the things that they do and I want to be perfect like them, because it appears like they're just doing everything right. They're operating on a whole different plane than you are, and you look at that and you think, that's what I want to do, and you get it in your head that these guys are just perfect. And the matter is they're just not. I mean, and nobody is. And I have to get a chuckle out of organizations that talk about perfect execution or perfect outcomes or perfect performance or perfect this or perfect that. I flew with the best pilots in the world throughout my career. My time with the Navy, my time with the Marine Corps, my time with the Air Force, I was always surrounded by these exceptional performers, guys that are just brilliant in an airplane. And all they do is make mistakes constantly, repeatedly. At every single phase of flight, there are mistakes, some big, some small, but everybody makes mistakes. And so I just got away from the idea of being perfect. And I even talked about in that article about redefining perfection. Perfection is discovering all your mistakes and figuring out what they are and explaining them. And the more you can tell people about the things you're doing wrong, the less likely they're going to repeat your mistakes. There's an infinite number of mistakes to be made, and the thing you wanted to do is avoid repeating them. So perfection is finding everything you did wrong. It's a dichotomy. It's that counterintuitive mindset. But if somebody talks about perfection, certainly in execution, that should be a red flag. That's just not a thing. And I learned that by being around guys that I assumed at the time were perfect. And when I got there, I realized they just weren't. They just really, really, really good at identifying all the things they did wrong and teaching me. And that became my goal, is to do that.
Right. And I think that's something that I see in my profession is the good firefighters, the good medics are the ones that are out there training. And obviously when you're training, you're putting it out there, and you have to remove your pride because you are going to screw up. And sometimes you might screw up royally. I mean, you might do something that's, you know, going to invoke laughter, but you had the courage to get out there and make the mistake. And as you said, learn from it. I think the cowards are the ones that refuse to train, that come up with a thousand excuses because they're too scared to show people that they're, you know, not perfect. And as you said, here we are talking to a Top Gun instructor saying about how he's not perfect. You know, I think that's a lesson that a lot of our first responder communities need to learn from you, is you've got to be brave enough to go out there and make the mistakes so you can learn and become the best version of yourself you can possibly be.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it well. I think there are enough sayings and quotes from really successful people throughout history for us to realize that that's simply just the reality of the world we live in. There's no such thing as perfect anything. You know, if we expect perfection, if we tell people perfection is what we want, they're going to try to achieve that. And the way they're going to achieve that is going to keep things from you. They're not going to tell you about their mistakes if you're telling them what you expect is perfect. I think the best lesson I took is don't tell anybody you want perfection. Tell them you want them to be as open and honest and candid about the things they did wrong. And if you do it right, you know, if you do it the correct way, and this is what we see at Echelon Front and the leadership consulting that we do in all these businesses, if you do it the right way, people actually volunteer mistakes that they could actually otherwise overlook. Because nobody saw them. They start to tell you about the things they did wrong because it's for the good of the company. It's good of the team. It's for the good of the organization. Because you can say, hey, I made this mistake. I was by myself. I was doing it. Nobody else saw it, but this was a mistake. And don't do this. Don't do what I did. And if you have the humility and the ability to kind of reveal those flaws, you're onto something that unfortunately is just very difficult for a lot of people, because I don't think it's human nature to want to run around and tell everybody everything wrong with yourself. Nobody likes to do that. It's a skill. It's a quality that is learned and has to be continued to practice and reinforced. So you're 100% right. And I think it's important that people recognize that. And if I can take it a step further, if any of your young folks are getting those lessons and you hear about perfection, you hear about, I didn't do anything wrong. Anytime you ever hear anybody talk about being perfect or being great or being awesome, you should be skeptical of that. That's just not, it's just simply not an objective that you should look to achieve. The objective should be is explain everything you did wrong to help other people avoid making the same mistakes as you are. And that's a powerful tool. And the greatest organizations I've ever been a part of, that's what they did. Whether it's in the military or the civilian world, you know, that's how relationships work. It's not complicated. It's just really hard to do.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what makes the training ground, or, you know, in your case, a training airspace, I assume, you know, so invaluable, is that that's where you can make mistakes and not kill someone. If you keep it to yourself, your mistakes now become lives lost.
That is exactly right. And that in any field where your life is at risk, that's a true statement. I can't imagine the burden of watching somebody else make a mistake that you could have taught them about that ended up costing them or somebody else their life. And that's why it's so important to reveal every mistake that you made. That's why it's so critical to be honest, forthcoming, and check your ego to talk about the things you did wrong in training. So when guys go get out there in the real world and do it, you're increasing their chances of surviving in what often can be really demanding, life-threatening situations. Every time you go fight a fire, your life is at risk. And the more prepared you are for it, the more likely you're going to succeed. And that's the job of leadership, is to train people to do that. And the way you do it is by talking about the things you did wrong. That's the only way to get better.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, talking about another type of mindset as well, one thing I found fascinating was another article that you wrote, I think it was Business Insider, and you were recalling your absolute just love of the job until you encountered landing at night on an aircraft carrier. So can you tell us that whole story?
I knew I wanted to fly airplanes off boats since I saw that movie. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I knew that it was going to be awesome. And when I did it in training, which I did probably 1997, I did it in a training aircraft. It was daytime only, and I loved it. And I did well, and I had a great time doing it. It was a huge rush and a huge challenge, and I had proven myself. It was the last thing I did in training before I got qualified as a pilot. In the Navy and the Marine Corps, if you fly off carriers, basically every jet pilot in the Navy flies off carriers. And my goal as a Marine was to fly off carriers as well. Your ability to take off and land from the ship is paramount. And if you can't do it, you're useless. You can be the best dogfighter or the best bomb dropper or the best pilot in the world. If you can't land on a ship, you can't do your job and you can't help the team. And the Navy and the Marine Corps have no use for you. So you've got to be able to do that well. And for me, knowing I wanted to be in a carrier-based squadron, and like you said at the time, there wasn't a lot going on. So if you wanted to get in and see any combat at all, being in a carrier squadron was the most likely way to do it. You know, this is obviously pre-9/11. I wanted to fly off carriers. And so I finished all my training. I got to the F-18. I did all my F-18 training. And the very last thing I did in the F-18 was carrier qualifications. And you do it during the day in the F-18, and the first time you do it at night is in the F-18. It's literally the last phase of training before I was all done and got to my first combat capable squadron. And I did my first night landing, and I'll be very blunt, it scared the hell out of me. Now, I think it's always scary for people the first time. Everybody's scared of flying on a carrier at night, or they get really anxious and nervous, and it's a pretty crazy, overwhelming environment. But I never got over it, and I didn't like it. And I was shocked that I didn't like it because I always kind of figured it would be the coolest thing in the world. Well, it wasn't for me. And it kind of got inside my mind and it made me miserable. I hated doing it. But if I wanted to do all these other cool things in an airplane, if I wanted to do all these other things that I love doing and enjoy doing and wanted to do, I had to do this thing called night carrier landings. But they sucked. I hated them. And I hated them throughout my entire career. And that for me, in retrospect, always presented the biggest challenge because I had to keep my composure and I had to keep myself able to do something that I just simply didn't want to do. I thought it was really easy through flight school to do work because I was super motivated. I loved what I was doing. It was so much fun. Every single flight and every single airplane was just fun for me. And when things are fun, it's easier to put in the work to do well. I had no problem dedicating myself to preparing for flying or doing the flying itself because it was fun. Night carrier landings were not fun. And it was the first time I found myself wishing I didn't have to do something in an airplane. And when your motivation is gone, the work doesn't come easy. It doesn't come naturally and it's not comfortable. So I kind of discovered early on in my career that motivation, that's not a very valuable tool. It dissipates very quickly when you're unhappy. I can't think of a single job where you're not going to have to do something that you don't want to do. There's always an up and a downside to every profession in the world. And just like anything else in the world, I came to realize that flying airplanes, there was part of it that I didn't like. And all of a sudden, that motivation that I had since I was a teenager was gone, like literally overnight, gone. And that was a big problem for me. And I needed to figure out a way to deal with that. And motivation wasn't going to be the tool that I used to figure it out.
Okay, so what was the tool that you found to get you to still do what now became almost a job instead of a love?
It was, well, night carrier landings absolutely were a job. There was no love at all, not even a tiny bit. The tool was the thing that Jocko Willink talks about all the time. The tool was discipline. There was no other way around it. I had to force myself to prepare for it. I had to force myself to do it. And I had to be methodical and deliberate and keep my composure when all I wanted to do was just be out of that stupid airplane. I hated it. The discipline comes from two things. One, like I said before, if I wanted to do all these other really cool, fun things in an airplane, and just about everything else in an airplane is awesome, dogfighting, dropping bombs, shooting the gun, all these amazing things, I love them. So part of the equation was if I wanted to get to keep doing the things that I really enjoyed doing, I had to do this other thing. I couldn't just avoid it. You know, I couldn't just skate by or skip it. It was just a fact of life. And so I had to come to accept that. I was being assigned to a carrier squadron. I eventually was going to spend 4 years in a carrier-based squadron to do two full deployments, well over 100 night carrier landings, somewhere around 400-something total carrier landings. It was just going to be a fact of life. And then the other piece was I wasn't interested in just getting by. I didn't want to just meet that minimum standard. I didn't want to just be average or mediocre or just good enough to just survive and get through. I had aspirations of being as good as I could possibly be. So the discipline was, I'm going to work really hard at something I don't like because I still want to succeed. I still want to do really well. I wanted to be as good as I could possibly be. And that wasn't fun in this case. And it was going to require me to be really deliberate in preparing and doing it. And by no means was I great at carrier landings. I mean, there's no shrine to Dave Burke as the world's greatest, carrier landing pilot. but I was able to succeed in my career as an aviator and thrive and do very well, even in places that I didn't want to be. And that was just a matter of doing the work, the tedious, unenjoyable, unfulfilling, unrewarding, miserable work. And I never thought there would be anything like that being a fighter pilot when I was a kid. How could anything be miserable or unhappy or tedious? Well, it turns out that it is. And that for me was the night carrier landing. And I never got past it. A lot of guys just kind of found their comfort with it and got past it. And nobody enjoys it. I mean, I don't think anybody really loves night carrier landings. But most guys don't have the misery that I had with it. They might find misery in some other phase of flight. But for me, that was it for me. Like I said, I wasn't going to just be average. There was no way I was going to let myself just kind of get by. I wanted to be a Top Gun instructor, all those things. You know, I don't think at the time I knew exactly what that meant, but I wanted to do well. I wanted to challenge myself to look back at my career and say I did everything I could possibly do in that industry. That's what I wanted. And that was going to have to happen. So you got to be disciplined. There's no other way to do it. You can't fake it. You can't pretend it and you can't skip it. You have to do it.
Absolutely. And I think everyone in every profession has areas, whether they don't like heights, they don't like, the confined spaces that we have to go to, whether it's just putting the hose back on the engine after a fire, whatever it is, there's definitely numerous areas in our profession where it's not walking out of a smoky building with soot on your face carrying a baby for the local paper to take a picture of.
Yeah. Everybody's good at the stuff that they like. Everybody's good at the stuff that comes easy. Everybody's good at the stuff they enjoy. The people that actually succeed are the ones that are willing to do the stuff that they don't like. That's the differentiator. It's the guys that just power through and slog it out and just get done what needs to get done. The tedious, unrewarding work, whether it's at your desk, at your computer, or anywhere else, like you said, putting the hose back on the truck, whatever it is, the ones that end up being successful in the long run are the ones that are doing that work. And that's why Jocko's saying that phrase, that idea of discipline equals freedom. That's why he's 100% right. That's why what he says is right. If you want the freedom to be great at something, if you want the freedom to be whatever it is that you want, it's not about the fun stuff. It's about the stuff that you don't like. And the only way to do the stuff you don't like is to be disciplined about it. But if you are disciplined about it, you get to have the freedom to be what it is that you want to be, however you define freedom, financial freedom, freedom to have time to do what you want, freedom from your parents if you're a kid growing up and trying to go out on your own, or in my case, the freedom to fly fighters in combat was my dream. That's what was freedom for me. It was the ability to do what I wanted to do. The difference for me was doing the tedious stuff that I hated. And that's the difference in every profession in the world, every single one.
Fantastic. All right. Well, you talked about Jocko. I want to talk, definitely kind of underline the next step that you took in your career that led you to Ramadi. So you'd been a pilot, you'd been to Top Gun, you'd actually become an instructor at Top Gun, but then you had a very different change in your career. So could you just talk about that and how you therefore met Jocko?
Yeah, so I was at Top Gun as the training officer. I was the senior instructor on the Top Gun staff, which is just the most amazing job in the world. As a Marine, too, not a lot of Marines get a chance to do that, and it was just the apex of my time at Top Gun was being the training officer. Just a great experience. Anybody that knows about Top Gun knows that job is just it's just an unbelievable job, once in a lifetime type thing. And I actually was thinking about getting out of the Marine Corps. I was going to leave the Marine Corps. I had just gotten engaged to my wife, and I had other plans, maybe going off to business school and doing some other stuff. And I thought that I'd kind of accomplished everything I ever dreamed of. I was a Top Gun instructor, and I felt fulfilled, and I felt like I was ready to do something else. And I just had this part of me that just, for whatever reason, felt like there was an aspect of my time in the military that I hadn't quite accomplished everything that I thought about. And I never really thought I'd about wanting to be a ground officer or being a FAC too much. But as I started to contemplate leaving the Marine Corps, I even had orders initially to go fly airplanes again. I was going to go back to an F-18 squadron in Japan, and that was kind of the plan. And it just sort of nagged at me. It didn't feel right. I felt like I was kind of taking the path against resistance. I remember talking to my wife about it quite a bit. Anyway, long story short, there was a billet to be a ground forward air controller for a unit in Japan. They were starting up this unit called Anglico. It was a 5th Anglico unit in Japan, and they needed pilots to do this. And there was a job that was available for a first-come, first-served volunteer basis. And I actually called the guy who assigns us our orders, and I said, I want to turn in my flying orders to Japan, and I want to do this forward air controller job. And because it was a volunteer billet, he allowed me to do it, and I volunteered to be a forward air controller. And I felt like doing that was going to be rounding out a career that was really successful on the aviation side, but I missed part of being a real Marine. I'd done 4 years on carriers, mostly with the Navy. I'd done 3 years at Top Gun, almost all with the Navy, and this was my chance to kind of do something that was very Marine Corps specific, and then I could leave the Marine Corps having kind of fulfilled all that stuff. And I did it just because I thought it was the right thing to do, and I just had enough, a little bit of service left in me to want to go do that. And that very quickly became evident that unit that I volunteered for was going to send guys to go to Iraq. So I got out to Japan, very quickly I realized that, they were going to send guys to go to Iraq from that unit. I was definitely going to be one of those guys. And then, even more narrow when they were asking for where guys were going to go in Iraq, as the senior guy, I remember filling out the list to where all my guys were going to go. My best friend happened to be in Ramadi at the time. I knew that was kind of the epicenter of the war. And, I volunteered to put my name on the list to go to Ramadi, to do that. And so, in a series of just insane decisions of volunteering to go do this, I found myself in Ramadi, in this, early parts of 2006, February of 2006, March 2006. And around the same time, SEAL Team 3's task unit Bruiser showed up. That was Jocko's task unit, and those two platoons that he brought with him. One of them was Leif's platoon, Charlie platoon, and very quickly found myself conducting ground combat operations in this crazy urban counterinsurgency war in downtown Ramadi, keeping up with two guys that, as you know, I respect and admire more than I can describe, who were central to the successful combat operations that we conducted in that war. And I fought alongside those guys. It was the honor of a lifetime. And obviously, as a result, we were lifelong friends and really brothers from that time there together.
Right. And I read again, one of the articles that you wrote, and I like this little sentence that you had where you said you were on a rooftop with Chris Kyle. And again, just like we were talking about before, it wasn't just him, you know, sniping like a video game, that you were up there for days at a time, just providing Overwatch instead of the glamorous Hollywood side that the average citizen is showing.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, so I knew Chris Kyle because Chris was Leif's lead sniper and point man. I didn't know, you know, we weren't close friends or anything like that. You know, I wasn't a SEAL, but make no mistake, and this is all before the movie and the book, I knew him just a little bit because one of his positions and one of his responsibilities as a sniper, they would do these Overwatch positions. Chris was responsible for, you know, providing Overwatch from the rooftops of these buildings that we would occupy. And that's the same job that I had. I had to get to the roof of the buildings and talk to airplanes. And a lot of times I would sit right next to Chris, again, not really knowing who he was in the sense of any celebrity or anything that he went on to do at the time. I was anonymous. He was relatively anonymous. He had a great reputation on the team. Everybody knew how amazing he was as a sniper, and he'd had already built up a fantastic reputation in those teams of being good. But my relationship with him was just sitting up on the roof and trying to figure out what was going on. And a lot of times he would talk to me about what he saw down alleyways or down roads, and he would ask me, hey, can you get a better viewpoint? I bring an airplane overhead. I tell him what I saw. You know, many times I would actually be laying down right next to him, just having a conversation with him about what he was doing. And what struck me at the time, and look, man, we would spend hours on these rooftops, I mean, hours up there. And it's the middle of the summer in downtown Ramadi. It's 115, sometimes even hotter up there, just a brutal environment. And that guy would lay in on the scope of his rifle, and it's like he wouldn't move. He was just... the amount of discipline that he put into what he was doing was remarkable. And again, remember, like I said, this is all before, you know, people knew who he was, certainly before any of those things happened. after that deployment, it was just a guy that I remember, and I've talked to Leif about at the time, and of just what it was like and what he was able to do. And he did just incredible work, not for any other reason other than the guy was just an insanely disciplined human being. And that's why he was so successful at his job. Nobody, not me, no Navy SEAL that I know had fun sitting up on a rooftop having the sun bake on you for hours at a time. But that was the job sometimes. It wasn't always just kicking indoors and throwing grenades and shooting your machine gun in these crazy firefights. Those were the rare occurrences. I mean, those things happened to those guys. Those guys did amazing work. But most of that time was marked by tedious operations that were required to support the Army doing their maneuvers. And that meant just enduring the elements and being disciplined is what it meant. It was the same thing for me, like landing on the boat at night. Just you had to do it, and you had to do it well if you're going to be successful. And I had the rare lucky opportunity to work alongside those guys and on few occasions to work alongside Chris and the rest of his team and see them do that. And to me, you know, I was just lucky to be a part of that that group, and I tried to contribute where I could. But I learned a lot from them. I took a lot of notes. And coming from Top Gun, I kind of thought I had things figured out. Those guys opened up my aperture even wider than it was, and it was really it was remarkable. Those guys were incredible. That task unit that Jocko led and that platoon that I worked with Leif were just incredible guys, incredible heroes. And I'm thankful for my time with them, and I'm lucky to continue to be a part of that.
Yeah, well, I also want to underline a couple of things. Firstly, the fact that, as you said, that you were up there for hours and hours, and his discipline and preparation would have saved lives the moment he did have to pull the trigger, even though he'd been enduring, as we talked about before, the not fun part of the job. But the other thing is the respect for you for taking yourself away from piloting the aircraft and putting yourself right in there in the middle of the crap with everyone else.
Yeah, it was an interesting decision. If you had my wife on the podcast, she might offer a different explanation or a different description of doing that. Look, man, and for those of you guys that are listening, I know we don't have a ton of time to talk about it, but I don't want anybody to think I didn't know what I was getting myself into. You know, there's no like hero story here at all. This is just at the time I just felt like I had more to do. Like I said, I was volunteering for a job that I thought would just kind of round out my experience. And then the Iraq opportunity came up, and I knew it was the right thing to do. My best friend was in Ramadi. I wouldn't have known anything about Ramadi if my best friend Neil hadn't already been there. I knew what he had gone through the previous 7 months, and I knew how insane that fight was and what a hell that was out there. And I volunteered to go do it, you know, because it was a chance for he and I to work together. We got to spend a couple weeks in Ramadi together, and that's where the war was. I mean, what was I going to do, volunteer for something else? But I don't want anybody to think that it was, you know, some big crazy hero movie. It was just what I felt I should do. I never anticipated the things I would do. I never anticipated working with Jocko and Leif and those their teams. In retrospect, it certainly was the most formative, most powerful experience. I endured a lot there, and I did my best to contribute and keep up. And I hope and I believe that the efforts that the Marines and my team, my Anglican team, contributed, it saved lives. I know Task Unit Bruiser did. I know that for sure. And I know Leif and Jocko and all their SEALs saved lives. And they made sacrifices to do that. You know, they took they lost men that died trying to save the lives of other people. And to be a part of that, that was the most powerful experience I've ever had. And to have a Marine on my team, a young man named Chris Leon, who was killed, to see men that I knew closely make that sacrifice was a stark reminder of what volunteering for service really meant. And I wouldn't trade that time for anything, but I'll be honest with you, you know, it was a challenge for me for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is that I was way, way, way out of my comfort zone. I was doing something I simply wasn't that comfortable doing because I hadn't really trained for it. But again, it marks the most significant contribution I've ever made during my 23 years as a Marine by a huge margin.
Right. Yeah. So that translates well to the next question. I'm gonna be respectful of your time and then wrap it up with a few short questions after this. But I'd love for you to just explain now. So Jocko wrote a book called Extreme Ownership with Leif. And then I know they created Echelon Front, and I know that you're a part of that group now. So can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I explained, you know, Leif and his task unit and Jocko was one of his platoon commanders were out there in Ramadi, and I built a close relationship with him. I worked with Leif quite a bit.
And he and I formed a bond. And we've stayed in touch ever since, as you might guess, you know, here and there. It's just a connection that you have with guys that you serve with. And when you share that common experience, and obviously when you share the loss together and as closely as we work together, you build this indelible bond. You know, Leif and Jocko went on to go to SEAL training. I went back to being an F-18 pilot and kind of went off to do my career. They did things in their Navy career, and they both got out of the Navy around the same time, and they started this company and wrote the book Extreme Ownership. And I was lucky enough to you know, be in touch with Leif when they did that. I got to see them when the book first came out and how successful it was. Got to spend some time with Leif when that first happened. And he had talked to me, you know, this is several years ago now, thinking about how great it would be if I could join the team. And I thought it was an awesome idea, but I was in the middle of my Marine Corps career and I never really gave it a ton of thought. But it turns out in the last couple of years, as in the latter half of my career, and I was having to make a really hard decision of whether or not I stay in or get out. You know, as I kind of mentioned to Leif a little while back, I said, hey man, you know, I think I'm going to retire. I had an opportunity to stay around and go back to flying F-35s and get promoted. And I realized it's not what I wanted to do. He said, hey, you know, come join the team. So I did an event with them, last year, with Leif and Jocko, and I just stood there as an observer, and I saw them, talk about the concepts in the book Extreme Ownership that they wrote, which came from our time in Ramadi together, and they did such an incredible job codifying these lessons that they learned, and it's written in a way that allowed me to understand that what we did in Ramadi was significant, the lessons that we learned were significant, and they translated perfectly well to everything in life, to include business. And I watched them translate this remarkable experience that we had together, this powerful experience, into something that was useful and viable and helpful and contribute and make people better and improve and could apply to every phase of their life. And I found myself realizing that, you know, I didn't want to necessarily stick around the Marine Corps and fly airplanes anymore, but I still wanted to be fulfilled in what I did and be connected to the things that I had done in my life. And the book Extreme Ownership and Echelon Front, the consulting company that Leif and Jocko started, was a way to do that because I could continue to contribute. I could continue to serve. I could continue to take all the lessons that I had learned. And it makes people better. It makes companies better. It makes individuals better. And it makes the country better. And it makes the world better. And it's fulfilling. And I can't imagine a more important adjective to describe what matters to me is be able to be fulfilled and be able to contribute. And so the chance to work with those guys again, two of the greatest guys that I've ever known, two guys that I respect as much as anybody, and do something that is a positive influence for the world. I mean, there's really nothing else that I care about. So I found myself very quickly saying, absolutely, I'd love to come join the team. And I've been with them since really last November. I kind of started that exploration phase with that first thing. And then, you know, come January of this year, I started working with them. And since I've retired, I'm on full time. And, you know, a small part of that team, that awesome team of Echelon Front and the work they're doing is just, it's incredible. And I've gotten to share my experiences and contribute to that and be a part of it and work with guys that I told you how I feel about them. It's awesome.
Fantastic. Now you call the seminars the muster, don't you? And I'm going to try and get to one in the not too distant future.
So you need to.
Yeah, I would love to. So could you just give us a very, very brief overview without giving too much away of what a muster would consist of?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the company Echelon Front does leadership consulting and executive coaching and speaking across every industry in the world that you could think of. And we do that and we go on site with all sorts of different companies. But we also do something called the muster. And we're coming up to muster number four. This will be the fourth one that we do coming up actually next month in September 14th and 15th. And the muster is a two-day immersive deep dive in what we would consider practical leadership. We take that experience from Ramadi. We take the backdrop of what we learned in combat. We take about what Leif and Jocko wrote about in Extreme Ownership And they basically lead a two-day leadership experience, which is 100% practical, where you walk away from those 2 days and you go right back to work and you take that and you apply it right away and you immediately get better. It's the most functional, useful, effective two-day leadership experience I've ever seen. And I have seen a lot, as you might guess, in my Marine Corps career. I'm well-versed in how military does leadership training, and there's nothing like the muster. And so I get to contribute to that. I get to speak there and be one of the leadership instructors at muster, along with Leif and Jocko and another close friend named JP Donnell, who's the fourth guy on this team of ours at Echelon Front. And the muster is incredible because it brings in folks from every single industry in the world, from all over the world, several countries, almost every state is represented, and several countries around the world is represented. And it's like-minded folks that want to get better. They want to be better leaders. They want to win. And they come to the muster and they get a chance to interact with Leif, Jocko, myself, and JP. And they learn a ton. And it's an incredible environment. And I've never seen anything like it. And they're incredible.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to try and get JP on the show as well. So that would be another great...
JP is a one of a kind. You need to get him on the show. He was in Delta Platoon, the other platoon, not Leif's platoon. Leif was Charlie Platoon, but the other platoon that was with us in Ramadi there. JP, I can't speak highly enough for that guy. He's just an amazing guy. He did some amazing things. He is a selfless human being. I've never seen someone so willing to make a sacrifice. He's an incredible speaker too. He's got an amazing personal and professional story. And yeah, you need to get him on the podcast. He's awesome. And he's also, like I said, at Echelon Front, part of the muster. He's as unique as they come, just an incredibly capable guy that is about as selfless as any human being I know.
Brilliant. Yeah, when Lynn sent me the email, she said, well, we have these two gentlemen. Would you want them on the show? And I read your guys' bio, like, I'm going to say, no, I'm not interested.
Yeah, so, Lynn, it's great to be here, man. This is awesome. This is as much of a thrill for me, I'm sure.
Well, thank you very much. So I'm going to close with some very quick questions and then let you get on your way. So firstly, is there a book other than Extreme Ownership that you would recommend to anyone? It can be any field at all.
Oh man, that's a good question. So in that field, I think, look, Extreme Ownership is the seminal book for me in terms of applying military experiences, just how it's all the same stuff. The leadership is the same. And that book is as practical as any book they come. I would say, look, people should read any book that's out there. They absolutely should. I mean, there's more business books, than I could possibly name. And reading is valuable. There's a book that we reference a lot about military leadership called About Face by a guy named David Hackworth, who's now a retired Army colonel, which is a really good book as well. The principles in Extreme Ownership, I think, because they translate so well to your personal life, the translation is to your professional life, and that just really applies to everything in the world. It's obviously convenient for me to say, but that to me is the thing that I would certainly recommend to anybody if they're looking to increase their scope. That's the book to read.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I've read Extreme Ownership, and I thought it was amazing. I love any book where it's a combination of someone's personal life story and lessons learned. I think it's so much more digestible than some, textbook or just boring read.
Yeah, and it's also, it just makes sense. The book just makes sense. And when you read it, you just realize that it applies, and it's just not complicated. And it's just, it may be hard to implement, but it's not hard to understand. It's just done really well.
Yeah, it's funny how most of the things that actually make sense in life are so simple, and we've just added so much fluff over the last few decades.
That is the God's honest truth. Things are just... The trick to life is that everything you're supposed to do is actually really simple. It's just hard to implement, but there's nothing complicated about it. There's no secret formulas or special way of doing things. You just got to get up and do the work, and that is the key to success. And there's some key principles there that are just very straightforward. Hard to implement for sure, but not hard to understand.
Okay, and then what about a movie and or documentary that you would recommend?
Oh man, a movie. Don't watch Top Gun. We don't want to fly fighters. There is Band of Brothers for me is just that's a mini series, obviously, but that one is just about as good as anything I've ever seen. I've saw that, you know, I've actually seen it a few times, and certainly when I think about my own combat experience, the authenticity of that, and the significance of that, is really powerful for me. There's a documentary actually about my time in Ramadi, that came out a few years back, called A Chance in Hell, the Battle of Ramadi. And several of the guys that I got to serve with, talk about their experiences there. And that's also an incredible experience, obviously part of it because I'm reliving a lot of what I saw. But it's really well done, and the trials of combat and loss and the sacrifice and the challenges of that are very, again, very authentic, and they come out really well. You know, so one's obviously, you know, more recent in my personal experience, but Band of Brothers also is about as good as anything I've ever seen to kind of highlight the realities of the brotherhood of going to war with somebody.
Yeah, it's by far my favorite.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Anything. And I actually worked with Captain Dale Dye years ago when I was doing stunts. So I had him on the show a few weeks ago.
Did you really?
Yeah, fellow Marine. So yeah, that was an awesome interview. So if you ever want to listen to him talk, he's on this show too. So there
Believe
you go.
Me, I will. Yeah, I'm going to do that right after this.
All right. So what do you do to decompress when you're not flying, you know, multi-million dollar pieces of machinery around the sky?
Yeah. So obviously those flying days are behind me, and that was always my favorite thing to do, is jump into an airplane. That was the highlight of my time. I'll say it. I don't know, you know, how it'll come across. My favorite thing in the world right now is when you talk about decompressing. Keep in mind, you know, I've got, I'm married. I got three kids. I got an 8, 6 and a 3-year-old, you know, I've transitioned to the Marine Corps. I'm working at Echelon Front. I got a lot of things. My favorite thing to do is to exercise with my wife. She and I get up early, you know, just about every day. Because life is getting past us very quickly, and there's, you know, like with everybody else, there's never enough time to do all the things that you want. There's some, you know, time to just myself that doesn't exist. I get to do, some fun stuff, you know, down in our basement, we'll go work out, work up a sweat. And, that turned out to be, I never exercised with her throughout my career. You know, as a Marine, I was off doing whatever I was doing. And we've kind of discovered that, that's a great way for us to stay connected as a couple, but it's also gives us something to do that's just really good and healthy for us, and it's a huge decompression, and it's awesome. So that's what I do with whatever time we can get before the kids get up and take over the homestead. My wife and I exercise together, and it's a blast.
Brilliant. Yeah, I've got my whole family. I coach at a CrossFit gym, and my
wife.
Oh,
nice.
And my two little boys go there. So, yeah.
Well, I've started into jiu-jitsu as well with on Jocko's guidance, and I've just started training there somewhat recently. And I have found that even though I just get annihilated and embarrassed every time, I have discovered that it is just absolutely. I've never had so much fun getting beat up in my entire life. And I've actually done a little with Whitney as well. The kids seem to kind of think it's interesting, which is cool. And I started into that as well. So on the fitness side, and then on that you know, development side with jiu-jitsu, that's just been an awesome, whole new experience. And at my age, I think it's critical to start or to continue to do new things that are outside of your comfort zone that you're clearly not going to be good at for a while. So I've started that, and that's been fantastic.
Brilliant. Yeah, I've got a little, he's 10-year-old now, but he started when he was 5 at jiu-jitsu, and I've done it for way longer than the belt around my waist shows because it's very on and off. But you're absolutely right. Again, with just like you were saying before about being brave enough to fail, it will humble the hell out of you. I think any martial art will, but you know, and if you're scared and you just stay in guard the whole time and never take any risks, you're never going to get any better.
Well, you know exactly what I'm going through being brand new, and obviously everybody I work with is not just bigger and stronger, but they're a lot better than me. But the beauty of that is, and I think it's probably synonymous throughout the sport, is everybody I've worked with, everybody I've rolled with, everybody I've trained with, you learn something from them all the time, even if they're just a little bit more experienced from you. And it's not about, you know, winning or losing or being humiliated or tapped out. It's about learning. And other than the fact that it's incredibly physically challenging, I mean, I'm exhausted at the end of our sessions, but I learn a ton, and I'm reminded again that if you just check your ego at the door and just accept that you're going to be embarrassed and you're going to be humbled and you're going to learn a ton, it actually is so much more fun than I thought it was going to be. I'm surprised at how much I enjoy it and how much I look forward to doing it when I'm not doing it. So that's been a blessing that was introduced to me. I got to thank Jocko for that as well. But I've really taken to that very quickly, and it's a blast. Not to mention it teaches you these incredible skills. It's great for kids. You want to certainly have two daughters. You want them to be able to learn to defend themselves. But it's kind of a microcosm of the story of my life. It's, you know, it's not the biggest and strongest person that's going to succeed. And jiu-jitsu proves to you that it's not about strength and size as it is about a whole bunch of other things. So I've really enjoyed it. But remember, I'm just a brand new novice, no real lifelong experience there. But it's been a great new journey that I've started on.
Yeah, so much fun. Now, I've got one more question before I ask about where we can find all your stuff, because you've got a very unique perspective, and I'd love to just you know, get your opinion just for a second. So I had Lieutenant Dave Grossman on, Lieutenant Colonel, Dave Grossman on a while ago, and he wrote On Killing, On Combat, all these incredible mm-hmm. books. Mm-hmm. And one of the areas he touches on is the proximity of the kill. So the closest being, you know, basically sticking your thumbs in someone's eyes, and the furthest being a drone or a pilot. Now, you've, unlike probably most pilots, got a very rare experience where you were in the plane a long way from where the kills were happening, and actually right in the middle of Ramadi, right next to, you know, the killing. So was it a shock when you found yourself close to the violence as opposed to further away?
Yeah, it's a totally different perspective. And certainly, you know, when you're in an aircraft, it's pretty insulated. You're certainly that distance. You never really see the outcome of that. So when I got to Ramadi, very quickly did the reality of seeing death and kind of that carnage that comes from ground combat. I started to see that up close. And it didn't all happen at once. I remember my first week or two there, the first time I saw someone get killed was in an IED, and then kind of seeing the aftermath of that. And then, you know, I started to see people real time, get shot and get wounded. I've seen combatants, enemy combatants, and the aftermath of that. And you see what ends up being some fairly gruesome injuries. I have some very clear recollections of those things. Obviously, I saw that on our side as well, to see guys on my team, to see American soldiers suffer wounds and get killed. And when it's up close like that, it has a powerful effect on you. Those are some images I won't get rid of. The sensations and the feelings of that loss is something I'll never lose. But it has given me a tremendous appreciation and understanding of what A is really going on in combat, what it is really about, and what that sacrifice is, what it means to be in that environment, as dangerous as challenging as it is. And it also makes me appreciate that there are men and women out there that are willing to make that sacrifice. And even though the most heartbreaking thing happened to me was losing Chris Leon on that deployment and having, you know, a Marine on my team get killed, it's given my son a name. His name's, you know, Christopher, Corporal Chris Leon was killed. My son's name is Matthew Leon Burke, named after him. And I have this profound, powerful relationship with his mother. And, you know, you do everything you can to try to keep their memory alive, and you do your best to honor them and remind the country of that sacrifice. And I would never have appreciated that and never known or understood that had I not spent that time on the ground there. And while I'd do anything to have him be back, I know that I can't. And that's just a fact of life. And I'm going to choose to be grateful for understanding what happened there. Had I not done this fact tour and spent my time in Ramadi, I'd never know that. I certainly just wouldn't appreciate it as much. So you got to look for the good in the darkness. And there's plenty of darkness out there, and it can be pretty miserable. And I'll be honest, it catches up with me at times. You know, I never get rid of it completely. My wife can speak to that as well. But you got to find the goodness there, and there's plenty of goodness if you look for it.
Right. Well, thank you for, opening your heart on that. I just wanted to underline that. I didn't want to put you on the spot.
No, not at all. No, I appreciate you asking. It's important. And I know I have no problem sharing that at all. And I'm honored to, believe me.
Okay. Because we have so many first responders that also see horrible things. Oh, yeah. And unlike the military, where at least there's some sort of acceptance of what you bring home, there's still so much stigma around police, fire, EMS with harboring those and almost being shamed into a fact that it's weakness. Yeah. And having someone like yourself, you know, yourself and Jocko and other people like that, they've seen the worst of the worst say this is a real thing. Doesn't mean it has to own you and crush you, but it's
correct.
A real thing.
No, you're right. I think you said that very well. It doesn't have to own you and crush you, but it's a real thing. And feeling those emotions and having those feelings, there's nothing weak about that. And I think it's a shame that there's any stigma associated with that. And I agree with you. It doesn't need to own you and crush you. As a matter of fact, what it really can do in the perfect world is that they can teach you the most valuable lessons in the world. That's the lessons that Leif and Jocko learned. And that's why they talk about the book Extreme Ownership. It's about experiences and mistakes and failures and hardships and loss and suffering and the lessons that came from that and how those lessons apply to the world, your world around you. And that's part of the reason why that book is so powerful and so effective. Is it's this book about loss and mistakes and the lessons that come from that. And it's rather than being owned by that, you're able to turn the tables on that, those terrifying and challenging experiences. And I think for the world that you're in, you know, I dabbled in that. I did a deployment. I was a FAC for a year. I spent 7 months in Ramadi, and I've never been back. You know, I don't have to sustain that. And I think in the world of first responders, certainly police, fire, EMS, people out there on a regular basis, paramedics, you're seeing, real time in the aftermath of carnage on a regular basis. And unfortunately, often without real good cause. You know, you lose someone in combat, you understand what's happening, but, you know, to have someone, you know, die in a car accident or just a tragic accident, I can't imagine how difficult that is. And I certainly think that we need to have the outlets to deal with that and find ways to make sure it doesn't own you. And for as often as we find out that it does, it's heartbreaking. And we need to be better at preventing that from happening. Yeah, I think what you guys go through, you know, it's a lifelong reality for you guys. You deal with it every single day. And that deserves an infinite amount of gratitude, respect, and appreciation. And you certainly got it from me, and I hope you get it from elsewhere too.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a mutual respect between the first responders at home and the military at home and overseas. But I think, again, that we are, there's so many commonalities between the two. And I think that, you know, if there's areas where we can help the military, it goes that way. And if there's areas from the military that can help first responders, then I think we need to do that too. And understanding that that is an injury, just same as a back injury or anything else that you're going to carry with you. And owning that, just like with the whole conversation's been about, and then growing from it, that post-traumatic growth is so important. And we need to, as a profession, create an environment where these men and women can actually talk about, just like you said, talk about the mistakes, talk about the pain as well.
Yeah, and I think the best way to do that is to capture those lessons learned and use them as a tool to teach and learn from. Capture and write down and codify those lessons. And it's the same thing we talked about in training, is the more you can teach other people, the more likely you're going to contribute to their survival and their success. And the harshest teacher in the world is combat. The harshest teacher in the world is the reality that you guys live every day. Like you talked about, that mutual respect. And I think the best way to own that and the best way to control that is to accept it, write it down, capture it, and teach it to other people, because you're going to keep them alive if you do that. You're going to help that. And by keeping it inside and keeping it yourself and wrestling with those demons internally, if nobody else benefits from that, then that's tough. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, well, the very final thing then, and thank you so much for this entire interview. You've been very generous, and I've had you on here for over an hour and a half, which is a lot longer than we discussed via email. So where can people find you and Echelon Front and all the other projects that you're involved with?
So Echelon Front's easy, echelonfront.com. That's our website, everything you possibly need on there. To include a link to the musters right up on top of that page, and you should definitely go check it out. The company's awesome. Obviously, the guys, Leif and Jocko and JP, are awesome guys, and what we're doing is fantastic. And the muster, if you can find a way to get to the muster, it'd be certainly well worth the time. If you want to get any information from us as a company, it's an easy email, info@echelonfront.com. Or if you want to just talk to me directly, it's dave@echelonfront.com. So I'd love to hear from anybody that has any questions or wants to reach out or connect with us or connect with the team. And be happy to make that happen. So get out there and check it out if you're interested.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to quickly interject. I'll edit this a little bit out. So when I'm going to edit it this week, this will actually be live on Tuesday. So I will email you all the links. Feel free to share it however you would like to do. And thank you so much again for being so generous. I really appreciate all the things that we've been talking about today.
No, look, man, like I said, I was honored to be a part of this. This is great. Thanks for including me, and hopefully you and JP connect as well.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you. I hope you have a great day, and I look forward to meeting in person at one of the musters very soon.
Right on. Talk to you soon.